session number 10081, reel 6.
It's a wonderful experience at that age, in the early teens and 20s, to become a member of the British Army, for the number of different types you meet, you see, and how they all get together. It's amazing. You see, you had the man who was always clumsy with his feet. You see, one chap would say, "Well, I think it's time for a cup of tea," and we had no heat. So what we used to do, the old froggies used to sell, I can remember the expression now, "Katsu de bougie," two candles for 2 sous. Used to buy candles, wrap flannel round, light it, put your cooking tin on top with water, and make tea. We used to use the iron rations there, and this chap was noted. Every time he made tea, he was the one man who used to knock it over. He had funny feet. You see, you meet some odd cases in the British Army, and there was another chap named Crow who could never keep step because he was pigeon-toed. He couldn't keep step. And he was shouting at him. But it's a lesson in itself, you know, when you think of the varieties of natures there are in an army, different people. There was a chap who was always getting drunk. He'd been sergeant 3 times and lost his stripes and got them back again. His teeth used to chatter at night when he went to sleep. He couldn't sleep, but he used to go out in the town and get drunk. But I told you about the field punishment. Of course, that was...
more about that. Yes. But before, you know, talking about the different people you met, I was wondering about, you know, your original battalion, the Liverpool Pals.
Yes.
Was that something very special, do you think?
Yes.
You know, I was wondering... You said about the types of people attracted to it. Do you think it made it of a different nature perhaps some other units in the British Army?
Yes.
Were the men very intelligent?
Very, very, yes. Oh, we had men there who they didn't want commissions or anything like that. They joined just because they wanted to go to war. They all had very good jobs, you see. White Star Line, Cunard, Cotton Exchange, all the big commercial firms of Liverpool, and all the Pals battalions were taken from. Most of them were office workers, very nearly that type of person, very intellectual. And and one chap I know, his name was Shrimps. Well, they soon got hold of him because he was a professor of German. Intelligence got him as soon as we got to France. They soon pulled him out and put him on the intelligence corps. See, like that, people like that were losing us. We were losing them, you see. But Shrimp was a very nice chap. And, of course, Liverpool, you had a mixed class of men in Liverpool, you see. You had the Italian colony, and you had a lot of Irishmen. One Irishman I know, named Rory O'Farrell, you couldn't have a better Irish name than that. He used to go mad. He didn't know what he was doing sometimes.
What, in the war situation?
Yes, in the trench sometimes. He used to pin him down. His Irish blood used to come up. Then he ordered one chap. He did go silly one night. He started to run on top of the trench, and there were a lot of dead Germans up there. One was hanging over the trench. And he goes on top of the trench, picks him up, and puts it over his head, and walks with it. Because they get super strength, you know, when they get in like that. And the colonel had to send 2 men and put him, chain him down. He'd gone, you know, just gone.
Yes, were there many cases of that?
Yes.
You know, men with, I suppose one would call it shell shock.
Shell shock, yes.
Yes,
yes, a lot of men, yes, yes, yes.
How did it take them, you know, apart from the man who took a jump on his head?
Well, you jump at every noise. Every little noise, you jump, that kind of thing. And you're not steady at all. Oh, a lot of cases like that. I remember going through the town of... after the war, I was on business. Runken. And I met this chap slinking round the corner. His name was Walmsley. I said, "Hey, Walmsley." He looked terrible. He said, "What?" I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "No." He said, "I haven't had work." He said, "I don't know what to do." He was the colonel's runner, the smartest chap in the battalion. He always followed the colonel wherever he went. It was sad now to see them like that. He was a wonderful chap, all warmly.
And he'd gone to pieces, hadn't
yes,
he?
Yes, absolutely gone to pieces, yes. They were a lot like that.
You were saying also...
Oh, and there's another friend of mine. He suddenly jumped up one day. This was in the office. He suddenly jumped up one day and started to run round the office, whistling Tipperary. And they couldn't stop him. They had to send for the medical doctor. He calmed down later on, but it just unhinged for time. There's a lot of that, you know. But as long as they're not dangerous, it's all right.
How about your own case? You know, did you manage to keep your nerves steady?
I didn't notice it, but I think I must have been very, very nervous towards the end. I couldn't stand noise. I can't stand a lot of noise now, really. I could never go into an engineering shop or anything like that to work. Could never do it. But I got over it. But I was very lucky indeed. Yes.
You were saying also about the punishment, you know,
yes,
that
yes.
this field punishment number
yes, yes.
one that you
yes.
saw. Yes, how did men react to that when they saw people crucified?
Well, they said it was the chap's own fault. He should have, well, I don't know what the crime was. It must have been serious for the colonel to order number one.
Did you ever hear of executions of, you know, people who'd deserted?
No, I've only what I've read in the book. I think there were 9, weren't there, in the war? I've read war books since. Oh. Yes.
I wondered also
yes.
if you ever met people who were conscientious objectors, who wouldn't fight for reasons of conscience.
Well, we had one or two left in the office who wouldn't join, but of course it wasn't recognisable like it was in the last war. You were simply told for some reason you didn't want to do, and they gave you some voluntary work to do, perhaps. Especially if you're a Quaker, if you're a real Quaker, they would know that it was part of your belief. Mm. And not a fellow of mine in the office, he was a Quaker, and they sent him to Bee's Nursery, you see, something like that, or an ambulance attendant, something like that.
What happened in World War One with them? Were they treated sympathetically or not in the First World War?
Well, I never came across any actual... Because, you see, I was away from the scene of civilian life. I was away from civilian life. So I don't know what happened to the people they mixed with who knew who they were. But I believe there were some funny things went on there. But also, I think there was a lot of men who should have been in there who were getting excused, I think. I think there's a lot of it going on. It wasn't fair, really, but you couldn't stop that, you see. See, some chaps, no, they wouldn't stop them going to war, no matter what happened. But some, on the pretense that they were essential to the business after the war, you see, well... It happened in the last war, didn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I was wondering also, you mentioned, you know, your pal who was sent to intelligence.
Yes.
In your job as intelligence, did you ever pick up German signals?
Oh, we used to hear them sometimes, yes. And then they brought out a new, instead of the old D3, there was somebody named Fuller. Fuller had made what they called a Fuller phone. Fuller. And we had those in the trenches. And it had a continuous buzz as a screen against Jerry picking up our signals, because he used to pick them up sometimes. It was a Fuller phone, that's what it was called, yes. Somebody invented it. But we used to get the football results in the front line, you know. He used to come through from England, through division. Oh, good, the chaps had to do.
Something else I was going to ask you. You mentioned, you know, at the beginning of the March offensive, you knew that was going to occur, that the Germans were going to... advance.
Yeah.
Did you pick that up on your signals then?
No, we didn't. It didn't come through to us in the front, except verbally, when we had the meeting before the 21st of March. but headquarters knew, army knew, Haig must have known, and all the right down to the Spectre Colonel knew too, because otherwise he wouldn't have devised this company keep idea. But it was hard luck on the men who were caught in there, wasn't it, really? Yes. But still, there you are.
Yes, but you know, what do you think the degree of panic was during those 9 days that you retreated?
Oh, yes. Panic.
The rout, was it?
They said no one knew what was happening. I went down one day, I went down one lane, I was so tired, I sat down on what I thought was boxes. And when I got up and looked down, I found I was sitting on ammunition boxes. So I said, get out of that other way quickly. You see, there wasn't a thing about it. The whole countryside was deserted. Just, the whole army had gone back. There was a place called Roye, R-O-I-E. That's south of France. That's part of the St. Quentin, coming back to Amiens, you see. And no one knew what was happening. It's amazing what scrapes you can get out of, isn't it?
Stage that the war had been lost or might be lost?
No, never.
It did sound pretty desperate.
I don't think there was always a hope that something would happen, but not to lose the war. No, we realized we had the best officers. We had good officers, and it never occurred to us that we would ever lose the war, because we always felt there was always somebody big behind us.
About your morale, though, you know, during your experience in France? Was it ever at a low ebb?
You see, you must take into account my age, mind you, my age was in the early 20s. But, no, to me it didn't. To me, it was a big adventure, you put it that way. But when I look back now and I say to some of the married men who came with me in 14, I've never experienced married life and the comfort of married life, but it must have been a terrible wrench when they found out what conditions were like on the Western Front. But the youngsters to say don't realise it. See, you don't, you see. You take everything as it comes along. And there's always so much happening all the time, you see. And if you've got faith in your superiors and your generals and that kind of thing, you know that you eventually win. Mind you, I'm not going to say I was afraid of the Germans. I was afraid of the Germans, because you'd heard so many stories about them. But they were just like you and I, weren't they, really?
What were the stories you'd heard about the Germans?
Well, it's all this, the raping of Belgium, and it's the media that causes all this trouble. Don't we were all, mind you, there are always men in the world who'll always like fighting. I mean, say the Irish, for example, they always love a fight, don't they? And there are certain generals who always like a fight, don't they? I mean, say, they've got to be hard, haven't it, to carry on their work. But generally speaking, we had a wonderful relationship. The two battalions I was with, just as I mentioned, was the 2nd City Battalion, Liverpool, and the Liverpool Rifles. I couldn't have had two better battalions in the whole British Army. They were wonderful. They looked after you and that kind of thing, and there was never any trouble at all. Amazing. Mind you, there were some black spots, because I think the authorities had to be careful in billeting that they didn't put certain regiments in the same village as another. For example, if they put the Black Watch, say, in one of the Leicester regiments, there's always trouble. The Tigers, there's always trouble there. They had to avoid that kind of thing. But you can always get that. I mean, say you get people in this country now who don't like the Americans, don't you? But it's...
You mentioned, you know, the state you were in after your 9 days retreat with your beards and what have you, and also the mud of Passchendaele. Did you ever get lice?
Yes.
Was that upsetting?
It was upsetting, but the thing that you've got to watch if you have lice is never to scratch, because once that gets in the bloodstream, that's when the trouble starts. But it didn't worry me very much, and yet I must have had, I did have them, because you know the old army way, I don't know whether I describe it or not, because it's rather not a nice subject, but you take a candle and you go along the seams. Some of them were big, but when you think that we were living and sleeping on earth, it's a wonder we didn't have something bigger than life. Isn't it? Rats were the trouble. They used to get in the earthworks of the dugouts, and one billet we were in at Bracer Song, because we stepped on straw, piles and piles of straw. It was a happy hunting ground for the rats, because the chaps used to leave bits of bread about, and we at night, sleeping at night, we used to hear the rats underneath going through for this bread. Oh yes. But when you're dead tired, if you're really dead tired, you sleep anywhere. I've slept on concrete, I've slept on earth, all duck boards I've slept on. But if you're really tired, you'll sleep all right. I mean, nature will get its own back. Nature will make you sleep. You know, like yourself, sometimes you've had a very busy day. But you make up for it, don't you? You have a sleep later on as it comes.
I was wondering also, you know, you've mentioned the dead bodies about.
Yes.
Did this mean that there were nasty smells and sights at times?
No, funnily enough, no. Mind you, it was very early when we came across them. They'd probably just been killed, you see.
They were soon cleared
up. If they'd been out there, say, a day or two with a hot sun, you see, it'd been different. But I did see one plane come down with a... And I went over to see the plane. It was the Air Force in those days. An officer was lying dead. But there again, you see, we couldn't do anything for it because we were on the move. If I'd have stopped, or even my friend had stopped, we'd have missed our battalion. And they'd have been kilometres away, you see. So you had to keep with your own unit all the time. We just went to see what had happened. But I don't know how he came down. And yet he lived just like an ordinary being. Wonderful officer, you know, Air Force man. Just lying there.
Earlier on, how you were relieved by the Australians.
Yes, yes.
And you seem to have quite a positive image of Australians, is that right?
Yes. They were happy-go-lucky, born gamblers. Officers and men were just like each other, not like stiff like we were always on this float, and they were good men to get along with. They took their offer this moment, and yet they're quite different to the Americans. We had a bit of job with those sometimes. Yeah.
Where did you see the Americans?
Americans came on the scene when, as I was telling you, after the early 18, because Haig, I believe, wanted to... Mind you, the British Army had already had American officers, because we had one, had been with us for instruction and general information, had been with us for some time. But Haig wanted to bring the American Army under his command as part of the British Army, but General Pershing wouldn't have that, you know. He wanted it, and that's why he had his own army, you see.
When did you first see the Americans?
First saw the Americans. They called themselves the New York Militia. They were all about over 6 feet tall, lanky fellows. It was down on Etaps on the coast. they're the first Americans, wonderful chaps. They didn't care a dash for anybody, and they had no money because the field cashier hadn't arrived. So they started to sell their own goods. You know, the army give you a razor, they give you all kinds of things. Well, they said, we're going to have it, you know, the Americans are, we're going to have the money. Our chaps were buying wonderful razors for 5 francs each and blankets. They sold their blankets and told everything. They said, well, it's not our fault. You should have given us the money. So they sold all the army stuff. Amazing. And they know that, when they say, and the words of command are quite different to the British. But they're very good chaps to get on with. Very good chaps. Our fellows got on very well with them.
Did you have any experience of them in action at all?
No.
The Americans?
No. I don't know what I'll identify. But they had a frightful time, didn't they? The first battle they were in at Chateau Thierry. You know, they had the baptism there of fire. You know what the Americans, cowboy style, rushing forward with guns blazing and that. Well, you can't do that with trench warfare.
You mentioned also when you were talking about the French and
yes.
their dirty. I think you thought they were rather dirty.
Well, they always smell of garlic, don't they, and that kind of thing. And because the poor beggars, I said, were only getting a halfpenny a day, and a lot of their homes they must have seen were destroyed as they get on there. France has had a terrible time, really. I couldn't think of it.
What did you think of the French as fighters generally? Were they respected, or did you have other feelings?
Didn't come in contact with actual French fighting men, but I should imagine they'd be pretty good if they were defending their homeland or something like that. But whether they have the same stubbornness as an Englishman or an American or Australian, I wouldn't like to say. I don't think they could stick, say, an intense bombardment. I don't think so. I think they'd crack like the Portuguese.
You mentioned also the Italians in passing earlier.
The Italians, yes, they were. I was only know that when Haig had to send a division to Italy because the Austrians were nearly through.
But did you meet Italians yourself?
No Italians on the Western Front.
No, I wondered about
it's only
that
what
because I didn't think. Only
hearsay and chaps
yes.
who come back.
Yes. No, it's really your own personal
yes, what
experience.
I've read, you know.
Yes, that's fine.
Mm.
How quick did your demob come through? Because after all, you were one of the earliest in, weren't you?
Yes, but you see, unfortunately, I was had to go to a territorial battalion, one of the best in Liverpool, and they were on different terms to our Kitchener's Army. We were there for the duration, so they could keep it there as long as they said the war's going to last. But a territorial army were on different terms. They went for a certain number of years. That's why during the war, a number of territorial men were discharged, you see, because they'd fulfilled their contract as a territorial. But Kitchener's army were different, you see, and conscripts were different. We were duration of war. They could keep you as long as they like.
So when were you demobilised?
Where was I demobilised?
Yes, yes. And when did it happen?
1919. Say the early months of 1919. I couldn't say exact month. And we were just... I had to take the people who already were in the territorial battalion. I said they were on a definite contract, they went before we did. On the other hand, the government said schoolmasters should go first, miners should go first. So there again, so I didn't mind having another week in Brussels, because I was able to go to Louvain, Ostend. It didn't cost me a halfpenny. I thought, well, I must have seen the place while I'm here. But they went early, you see. And it was a difference between the Kitchener's army and the territorials.
So when you were demobbed, were you given anything after the war? Did they provide you with any?
I stayed on till the time came to be demobbed, and you were just told, well, you'll be leaving on a certain date. Have all your kit ready. my first job was to pack up all the signals equipment, get a signature for it, and pass it over to the quartermaster. He was responsible then for anything that went wrong. Once I've done that, I was free. Then they said to me, now, all of us will be leaving on a certain date, train at certain date, Brussels it was. Then we just went on the train, medical examination at the coast port, Boulogne, then over to England. We went to a place called Priest Heath, where I got my wonderful gratuity and told I could go home.
How much was your gratuity?
£42. But £42 is a lot in those days. £42, but it doesn't seem much, does it, really?
Yeah. When you look back at the Great War, you know, did it have lasting effects on your life, do you think?
Yes, I think it did. It enabled me to see other people's outlook on their life. And they used to, funny thing, they used to come to me with all their troubles, and I don't know why, but and the different characters you meet. There's one character named Clark. I think he must have been duty in his early life, but he was a real colonial. Well, of course, naturally, he didn't stay with us. He went to the Pioneer Corps because he was ideal for that kind of work. But, you see, you meet all kinds of people there. It's an experience. It's wonderful. And I don't know why we don't have conscription here. It could do some of these fellows pretty good to have a few weeks. I think so. But you meet some good fellows. You meet some good chaps. Mm. And Liverpool has got special sense of humour in Lancashire. I don't know what it is, but they see a funny side when another chap will start crying.
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? All the things you saw, the grim things. Yes. Did you laugh a lot while you were
at
the front? You had your own jokes, did
yes,
you?
Yes, yes.
He'd laugh if you were dying.
Well, especially as I was telling Mrs. Smith when we got to Bayeul and we got to the ladies' shop, all full of, we hadn't had a change for a few weeks, to watch this chap chasing him around with a pair of ladies' knickers on down the French village. That was made us laugh, I tell you. But he was pleased because, I say, filthy stuff he threw away. I don't know where they went to. But,
how easy was it, you know, when you returned after you were demobilised, to fit back into civilian life? Oh, did you adapt quite easily?
Very easily, yes. Oh, yes, yes.
Mm, was that because you were with your Liverpool pals
yes,
all the time, do you think?
Yes, back to my own village and all my old friends. Missing my way, a lot were missing, but I got into it very easily.
I wonder, at the end of the war, you know, what had been achieved. Was it worthwhile for you?
I don't think we gave it much thought because we were so damn glad to get out of it. We were jolly glad to get back to ordinary life again. It was lovely coming back and knowing you could sleep without any interference at night. And coming back to your own people was very nice. Because it was a lovely little, it's a lovely little village. It's a town now.
You were saying, though, that you were a bit nervy. Is that right?
Oh, Con knows that. Used to hide under the stairs. Thunder reminded me of the artillery.
Did that go on for long, do you think?
About a year, I should think, after the war finished. I couldn't stand noise. As I was saying to you the other day, I couldn't work in an engineering shop.
Well, you look absolutely marvellous for 90, don't you? You look nowhere near it. You know, when
I get a bit tired, you know, sometimes, really.
So you haven't done badly, have you, when you think of what you went through?
No, well, I must say I was extremely lucky in a way.
Yeah. Did you feel that when you know that, wonder why you had survived the war when so many of your pals...
No, well, you see, in the early 20s, you don't give serious thoughts to things like that. You just go on day after day. And don't forget, in the British Army, you're part of a machine. Every day is different somehow. You know you've got parades to do, you know you've got duties to do, and you take the bad, you know, with the good. For example, I hadn't been in France a week I was talking about Heberton, a place called Heberton in Fort in 15, where we went for instruction, and the signal station was in a cottage that in course of time had become embedded in the trench system. So the cottage was part of the trench system, and it was company headquarters, and we had our telephone there. And I'd only been in the trenches about a day, and my friend Binns had taken over on the telephone, and the telephone was in front of the window of this cottage, and the window was facing the German lines, you see. And I was just having a snooze one day, and there was a sudden call. He said, "Oh, the window's gone in where the telephone is, and my friend who was at the telephone had been knocked out." You see, now if I'd had another change of duty, I'd have been sitting where he was. So I had to take over from him. I thought.